You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hi there, I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Welcome to the show. And this is one of my very favourite comedians, a man I was very, very thrilled and pleased to have onto the show when we recorded this live at the Edinburgh Festival at the Gilded Balloon earlier this year. It was a travesty that this man didn't get nominated for or win any of the awards at the comedy festival. He had one of, if not the best show up there. This is Mr. Eddie Pepitone.
Hey, thank you for having me. Hi, everybody.
Yeah, nice. it's a very friendly, gentle sort of Sunday afternoon show.
I like just chatting like this as opposed to what I normally do, which is scream just about rage and insecurity. Yeah. I like the chat format. I wish that, you know, I could do like a 1 a.m. show here and just be like, hey, everybody.
You walk off stage and go into sort of mellow mode and go, oh, here we go.
That's I got eaten alive by an audience. I had never done the late and live show.
Mm.
And I had never really, you know, it's my first time here. And they just literally, I felt like they would have, you know, literally eaten me and boiled me in a pot if they could have, you know.
That's strange. Why do you think that was? Because if you're not aware of Late and Live, it's billed as the comedy abattoir that has slain 1,000 comics. And I've done it several times myself. And it's it used to be certainly 10 years ago. It was the gig all the other comedians went to see because like how's everyone going to cope with this audience? I would have thought that someone with your stage persona, you know, the shouting, howling, pain and rage and all that would have chimed with that audience.
Right. You thought wrong. on that one.
Yeah.
No,
I'm aware I'm opening the interview by asking you to describe a recent horrific gig.
Well, I brought it up. Yeah, I brought it up. But yeah, it was a rough thing. And you know, one thing I find as a stand-up is that I always need to do a show at least once to kind of get the lay of the land and know what to expect.
Sure.
And also as an American coming here for the first time, and this is my first time actually in Europe, which is sad but true. I don't know, you know, any of the regionalisms, like the real specific things that people talk about, especially on a show like Late and Live. They're where are you from? And they get really specific. And I'm just trying to do all this conceptual stuff that they don't want to hear. That, you know, I'm like, well, hey, what if a magician? And they're like, bleh, you know. And I was like, what? I need love, you know. But, you know, I did scream at them for it. I was supposed to be on stage for 20 minutes, and I think a lesser man would have left after one, but I stayed on for 17 minutes just screaming at them, you know. Telling them that I'm better than them, even though they hate me.
It's nice that... It must be nice to have that option as a comedian. Like, what I do on stage, I'm kind of a charmer, and I try and charm the audience, you know.
I do that, too.
If they hate... Well, of course, yeah, absolutely.
You have to. Even if you're rageful, it has to be a charming ragefulness.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean?
I don't have that thing to... Like, if it bombs and they don't are not charmed by me, the most I could do is sort of stamp my foot and then...
Yeah, no, that's rough. That's rough.
You can just unleash the...
Right, then I get even crazier, you know, and,
Must be good to know you've got those gears. You can just hit the red button and go, well, this isn't working. I'm going to drive it into the ground.
Yeah, that's what I did.
So just to put you into some context, we were chatting a little bit about how long you've been doing comedy. So for anyone here or listening that hasn't seen your work before, and I must say, if you haven't seen Eddie's show this year, you must go. It's like a bomb's gone off at the Edinburgh Festival. So many comedians go, oh my God, have you seen? You're the hottest ticket here, I would say, amongst the comedians I've spoken to.
Oh, that makes me glad and nervous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, oh my God. Like, it's, you know, I think that's part of being a comedian too, is that it's so hard to accept any kind of, and that's terrible, so hard to accept any kind of compliment, success, because part of being a comedian, a big part of it, is just being so antithetical to everything.
Yes.
Like, oh, really? They like me? Well, fuck that. That's fucking bullshit. You know what I mean? Because for me, you know, the whole process is about, you know, me railing against things, about the way things are.
Yes.
That's what drives me. Like, I'm just not one of the, like, imagine, you know, if you're someone who just, you know, what would a comedian be like who's like, hey, everybody, everything is terrific, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's nothing to talk about. Like, that's a beautiful shirt, sir. And that's it. You know what I mean? Like,
it literally is
what
great
a lovely,
to be
lovely
here.
Person.
Yeah.
Okay. Good night, everybody. What a beautiful world we live in. You know what I mean?
So does that come from that antithetical nature? That seems very honestly your approach. It's not like something you've put on for comedy. It's not like, okay, now I'm gonna do this.
I owe it to my father, who was antithetical about everything.
Okay.
You know, my dad, Sicilian, school teacher, from New York City, grew up in New York City, and he always railed against everything. And I really, you know, picked that up, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's part of your, an aspect of yourself that you let to the fore? Is there an Eddie Pepitone show where you can talk about the stuff that you like? Or could you not ever see that happening?
I should talk about stuff I like more, you know. Maybe as I age, you know, I'm 53. Maybe by the time I'm 75, I'll have a show about squirrels. I love squirrels. I'll come to Edinburgh and do a whole hour on how I love feeding squirrels with walnuts. And I would love to do that at Leighton Live. Like... For that brutal audience.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, we hate fucking squirrels.
You know?
And I'll be like, yeah, but they're very gentle folks.
Dude, that might be it. That might be the key to you doing Leighton Live, is you go back there next time and you go, right, ladies and gentlemen, here's the squirrel stuff. And by the end of it, they're just eating out of your hand, just all sitting cross-legged on the floor.
Squirrels eat out of my hand.
Well,
so why not the Leighton Live audience?
That's how you're going to get them.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your origins as a comedian. You were telling me before you've been doing stand-up for, was it 15 years?
No, I've been doing it on and off. You know, well, I started comedy, I would say... Well, forever, because, you know, I was one of those kids who, you know, I just found my way into social acceptance through being funny. I mean, I was that typical guy who, you know, got acceptance into the cool kids by being funny. You know what I mean? Since I was like, I would say about 9, I started my secret comedy career. But then for real, I started it, I my dad was a, you know, he wanted me to be like a doctor.
Okay.
So he was, and he was really like forcing me into like a really good college in the United States. And there was just no way my mind could do like that kind of thing.
Okay.
Like I was just so emotionally disconnected from, you know, math and all that stuff.
Sure.
So I think I started when I was around 20.
Okay.
I started, my first thing I did was I wrote a funny one-act play.
Okay.
And it got produced by the college I was in. So that kind of, then I was like, oh, I'm funny. You know, I'm funny for real. And then I went from, you know, I went from, I always have been interested in writing, mm-hmm. you know, and I wrote a couple of plays. You know, being from New York, I wanted to be like a Broadway playwright. But that never happened because my discipline with writing is very shoddy.
Okay.
Like, you know, it's very hard for me to sit down and just write for hours the way real writers do. My mind is more like I think of like I get inspired mm-hmm. by particular ideas.
Sure.
And it's very sporadic, and then I write that down and I revel in that idea, but I have to then share it. Like, it's so hard for me because I find the writing process to be very lonely. You know what I mean? Like, you're not, I'm such a live performer. You know what I mean? So I need to take the writing or the ideas and like, I kind of write in front of an audience. But so I started doing plays, and then I went into stand-up when I was about 20, and I found it so frightening when I first started. I was in New York, and I stayed with it. You know, you do open mics, you do these, you know, where you're just performing in front of comedians for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And I think I did it for 1 year, and I just couldn't stay with it, you know, as a solo performer. So I started doing sketches, you know, with other guys. And then I joined an improv company that toured the United States.
If we could just talk a little bit about that experience, that first attempt at the open mic circuit, because I know a lot of the listenership of the podcast of this show is newer comedians. And that's certainly something that a lot of people will be going through as we speak.
Yes, I just want to say in advance, I'm sorry you have to go through that.
Yeah. It's hideous. It's hideous. When there's so few real audience members, you're turning up at gigs, and I'm fortunately not in this situation anymore, but I know a lot of people who are trying to find gigs in an increasingly, there's a surplus now of comedians. There's
there's a surplus.
Yeah, well, I think.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think in the UK, my feeling is that the cat is out of the bag. Like, everyone has got, stand-up's been so promoted on TV, it's exploding at the moment.
Is that right?
Yeah, I when I started 7 years ago, if I would tell people I'm a stand-up comedian, I wasn't full-time then, but I still would tell people. I'd say I'm a stand-up comedian, and people would go, wow. And now when I tell people I'm a stand-up comedian in the UK, people go, oh, yeah, my brother's having a go at that. You know, this is genuinely true.
You think it's because, is the economy bad in the UK like it is in the United States?
Yes.
This is my theory. This is my theory, is that people can't find jobs anywhere, and they're like, fuck, I could do that.
Yeah, I will.
Like, instead of being a doctor, I'm going to get on stage and I'm going to tell jokes.
I certainly think that it grows exponentially, because the more people do it, the more people go, oh, this is actually an opportunity. This might have seemed like pie in the sky, but actually this is entirely possible. And so many more people. I went to see a therapist, a cognitive behavioral therapist, for the first time. It's the first time I'd seen this guy.
Hold on, a cognitive behavioral therapist attempting stand-up? Or were you getting therapy?
I was getting therapy.
Good.
I went to... No, I see what you mean. But it's worse than that. I went to see this guy, at, you know, to get therapy from him.
Yeah.
And
Good for you for helping yourself.
Oh, thank you. And he said... he said, so you're a performer? I said, yes, I'm a stand-up comedian. And he said... oh yeah, I'm having a go at that myself. That's not what you want to hear, is it?
No.
Oh my God.
I would have left
Oh, well, I did. I left. I'm really sorry. I can't face A, the possibility of bumping into you on the circuit. And B, I can't stand the idea that, like, a lot of my problems are to do with stand-up comedy. And if you are still in the position of thinking it's this amazing thing to aim for, you right. could be no help right, right. to me at all.
I think it would be hilarious if you were comparing one night and he was the guy you were introducing. Like, this next guy has really helped me get through a lot of issues. And he has turned my thinking around through, you know, a tremendous... Anyway, I think even more than a comedian, he's a therapist, but tonight he's a comedian. You know, that'd be funny.
Ridiculous. So it's happening everywhere. So this experience of being an open spot, an open mic comedian in front of an audience that largely consists of other open mic comedians who aren't a real audience. And if you... you
and
know
they aren't very giving a not. Lot of time. They aren't very giving is an understatement, because they're there, like they're also, because when you're first starting out doing open mics, you're usually terrified
yeah.
and you're very insecure. So your audience is consisting of people like, I hope he isn't funny.
Yeah, totally.
You
I
know,
hope he
like,
isn't a threat to me.
I hope he yeah. isn't a threat to me, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's, you often get false positive like reactions from those gigs as well. You might say something that's very funny, but it's only funny to comedians. And they're only laughing because they can see that you're not managing to get across what you want. And so then when right. you take that gig, you go, oh, this stuff kills in front of my open mic friends. And then you go to an actual gig and people look at you and they go, no, you know, if you, yeah. if you're on stage going, hey, that was a callback, you know, and doing all this kind of pseudo revealing of the structure that might delight other newbie comics, people will just look at you.
You know, what you said there that really caught my attention was that you know, they're saying things that are only funny to comedians.
Yeah.
Like, what's that about?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm asking you now.
Well,
like, what? No, I turn the tables on.
Switch chairs.
On podcasting. Think I'm going to do all this work? No. But that is an interesting thing, because I struggle with that still, because I'm known as the comics comic.
Yeah.
Which means he's not really that funny to mainstream people.
I think in your case, I think it's a kind of a... when I've come to see you, and I saw you at the Tron a couple of nights, I saw you on your first show here, and I've seen some of your other shows. I can see lots and lots of comedians in the audience.
Yeah.
And I think that's a positive thing, because
yeah, I do.
There is a delight in other comedians. Oh my God, we didn't know you could do this. Do you know what
right.
I mean? And that's... So I think that's
right.
that's your kind of end of it. But I think in the open mic circuit, what I mean is
yeah.
when you're doing... like, you know, if you... Like, there'll be three comics at the back of the room at a regular, like a commercial club. You're playing Jongleurs or somewhere. And it's a commercial club. It's full of stag do's and hen do's. Three comics at the back of the room. You'll say something. It fails to get a laugh. And all three comics piss themselves.
Well, first, you know, part of that is that comics love when they see a thing fail to get a laugh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's something so funny about watching another comic completely just absolutely not connect with an audience.
Yeah.
And you're just like, ah. That is so funny, because I've gone through that so many times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost an observational comedy experience. For comedians, it works yeah. like observational comedy.
Yeah.
It's almost like something about the dying comic is saying, yes. hey, you know when this doesn't work? And the people at the back of the room go, yes, I know exactly what that's like. So, I've got a lot to get through in this little section. Please don't skip ahead. Some of it's important. Some of it will be very good for you. I'll try to do a little bit less relentless plugging and more just telling you about important stuff. So, first things first, Eddie's album, A Great Stillness, is out now. You can listen to that. In fact, if you haven't already heard it, why not pause this and then go and listen to that album or watch some of his stuff on YouTube. And you'll really, if you've not seen him before, he's just incredible. So you might feel a little more informed if you do that before listening to the rest of the show. But you can buy his album from his website, eddiepepitone.com. The album's called A Great Stillness, and a documentary about Eddie's life on the comedy circuit as a comedian's comedian, in fact, is called The Bitter Buddha, and there's a link to that from eddiepepitone.com as well. I'm in love with Eddie's comedy. If you missed it at Edinburgh, you are going to get bored of people telling you how amazing it was and how dumb you are to have missed it. He's an incredibly fascinating, funny, very literate man, very articulate, very insightful. He's got the benefit of many years' experience of
performance of one sort or another and a fair bit of time on the comedy circuit. And we'll be talking about how and indeed why he makes his comedy, how he writes for Twitter, and some really interesting stuff on Eddie's views on improvisation and how he uses that to make material. A couple of important things. I got a reader's email. I got an email from Brian Manton, who says, I'm sure I'm missing, I'm operating on some missing information, having only listened to two episodes, but why do you seem to try and pimp out your daughter at the end of each podcast? It's like Taken in reverse. You're looking for someone with a particular set of skills who'll take her off your hands. Well, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for that, Brian. Just to remind the rest of you who already know and tell Brian and any new people, this is a code word that comedians can say to me if they'd like to be on the show so that I know that they're fans of the show. If they can get in touch with me or when I see people at gigs or if they want to email or tweet or whatever, and simply say I'd be very pleased to be introduced to your beautiful daughter. It's already worked. One of the first cases of this happening is the incredibly interesting and lovely Mike Gunn, who sent me such an email. I went round to his house earlier this week, and I'm going to be releasing that episode of a brilliant conversation with Mike next week. So that's the beautiful daughter thing. You can still submit your new hack at comedianscomedian.com/new hack. These are things that, well, we'll just have a little reminder of this. New hack are things that you are absolutely sick to death of hearing comedians get laughs from on stage. There are rules up on the website. It's not just for any kind of hack. It's not personal. It's not a witch hunt. We're not attacking any individual. It's just those things when you say to yourself, oh, I shouldn't have said that. That was really lazy. And the fabulous and very funny Kai Humphreys spotted a common piece of what I'm calling meta hack. He texted me recently and said, a bit of new hack is when you come off stage and say, when I did that stock line, a bit of me died. Brilliant. We're taking this into several new levels. Now, very exciting news, as promised. There is a special Comedians Comedian Live coming up in February. On Wednesday, the 6th of February, I'm going to be talking to wonderful comedian James Acaster. I'm going to host. We'll have a support slot, and then James is going to do half an hour of his favourite stuff and some new stuff as well. Then we'll have an interval, and after the interval, I'm going to interview James for this podcast. So everyone will get to hear the interview bit. If you're a podcast listener, you'll get to hear that when we release it. But to properly appreciate the interview, or appreciate the interview even more so, you've got to come and see the gig. How's that? So James is amazing. He was nominated this year for an Edinburgh Comedy Award, not before time, and he's been supporting Milton Jones on tour, as well as being a tremendous act. He's also very, very articulate about comedy, so it should be a really awesome show. So please do come and see that. Tickets are £6. It's on Wednesday, the 6th of February. I know that's miles away, but I kind of want to start banging the drum for it now and giving you a chance to get in and get your tickets if you haven't come to this episode yet, if you see what I mean. You can leap in and get tickets now from a link on the Facebook group. I think this will sell out, so please get stuck in quick. You can also find, if you're not on Facebook, you can go to comedianscomedian.com, and that's the sort of basic website for this show, and it's got a link to the Facebook thing on it there, so you can actually read the link without needing to be in Facebook, which seems only fair. A very quick reader's email now. This is from Dave Miller. Dave says, during the most recent podcast, you expressed a concern that it was not reaching non-comedians or perhaps held no interest for them. While I consider myself a comedy nerd, I'm no comedian. What I am, however, is a writer of short stories and poetry, and I'd like to tell you now your podcast is an amazing insight into the creative process. Kind regards, Dave Miller. Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate knowing that. Thank you very much. And I'm also a big fan of the sign-off, kind regards. On that subject, I've been really blown away by everyone's response to telling me they're funny for no money. Thank you. Thank you, non-comedians, you special, special people. It's lovely for the comedians not to be the special ones for once. Thank you, non-comedians, for telling me that you're into the show, that you're getting stuff out of it. I really appreciate knowing because, let's be honest, the number of comedians is sort of finite, isn't it? But the number of non-comedians, although I will admit technically finite, can go up and up in terms of the listenership of this show. So you're the people we're after, and I'm really glad that you're getting something out of this. Why not? So I've got a little game for you this time. Bear in mind, this is only available to my non-comedian listeners. Comedians can play, but you're supposed to be funny. So this is a game on Twitter, and comedians will have the handicap of me reading their tweet while smashing my shin against my IKEA Malm bed, just to sort of take the edge off the funny and give you a bit of a handicap. Here's the game. I'm going to do a show at Edinburgh next year. Who knows? Maybe I actually am, but for the purposes of this game, I am. I need help with the title, and the two subjects it's going to be about are sea creatures and war. So I'll start you off. The show could be called Stuart Goldsmith, Shell Shock, or possibly Clambo. it's awful laughing at my own stupid joke there. Non-comedians, tweet me at ComComPod with the hashtag funnyfornomoney and give me suggestions, please, for an Edinburgh show title that was about sea creatures and war. Rock those together. Comics, you can join in as well, but you have to use the hashtag HackForCash, and you get double points if you're using the numeral 4 in the phrase hack for cash. That's all of the stuff I'm going to chuck at you at the moment. Now let's get back to Eddie. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks of course to Eddie for agreeing to come on the show. Very, very excited, and I'm just find it thrilled listening back to this. So pleased he came on. I shall return you now to Mr. Eddie Pepitone.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So in terms of your we're talking about your genesis as a comedian. So you got into doing improv shows.
Well, yeah. What happened was that it takes so much courage, you know, to do stand up, because when you first start out, it's very rare. I think, even though it seems to me there's more young people who are more with it, but for me to find, you know, not to talk in a cliche, but to like find your voice, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, because when you're first starting out, basically, and this is me, and I think this is what a lot of comedians do, is that they come on stage and they're like, I have a funny idea, or I have a funny thing that I've written about raisins, and they come on stage and they're like, so folks, isn't it crazy that raisins are really shriveled grapes? Or, but what I mean is that they're not connected. They're not connected to what they are saying. They are just speaking ideas.
Yes.
And, you know, they haven't, because to me, the really good stand-ups are people who can take their lives, their actual lives, and they're fearless about, like, okay, here is my life. Mm. And, you know, and they know how to make it funny, and they're not embarrassed about their life, because people usually starting out are just terrified of revealing any truth.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I remember someone saying, only the truth is funny. You know what,
sure,
I mean?
Sure.
Like, only the truth is funny. Like, but there are really clever guys who, like, do, I'm just thinking of, like, Dimitri Martin and Zach Galifianakis, how they just can write one-liners,
sure,
that are very funny. You know what I mean? But yeah. I think even that, to get to that thing is a process. Like, they found that that's who they are, and it takes years.
Yeah. There's a thing happening in British comedy at the moment with a lot of young people starting comedy.
I saw that at the festival, just this young kid, I forget his name, he was very good performer, and he was just talking about his mom and dad.
Yeah.
All the time,
yeah.
You know,
well,
but it was really good, you know.
I think to a certain extent, the industry, kind of the UK industry, certainly fetishizes youth. And at the moment, it's all, it's
that's
like,
all
it's
they
like
do
the
in the United
industry.
States. If they, sure, could, they would just have toddlers on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
In the how you doing? That would be funny, yeah, if it got younger and younger, and like stand up became dominated by toddlers.
Yeah. They'd be doing all the squirrel material. They'd be like,
no, they would be just doing like, oh, you know, a funny thing happened today. I made in my diaper, but then I didn't tell anyone. Thank you very much. I'd love to do a toddler comedian,
yeah,
actually.
That would be great.
Like, just come out, and it would look horrible.
Yeah.
It might be really funny. That might be, yeah. You see, that's how I write, by the way, and you're talking about the process,
yeah,
is that, like, I am, are you okay?
I'm fine, thank
Medic.
You.
Medic! But the way I feel like I come up with most of my good ideas is in front of audiences like this, or talking to other comics, particularly like when I'm just hanging out with other comics and we just, you know, comics just talk in a specific language.
Sure.
Like comics don't just say, hey, I really like to shop. You know, comics are they just immediately go into, you know, that specific language to comics about, you know, being kind of acerbic about it or, mm-hmm. you know, specific veins. But like the toddler comedian, I think I might try, you know. You know, yeah. Like, good evening. I didn't get my nap, so bear with me.
And the reveal...
It might get old really fast, though, if I'm in, like, a diaper. Because that's what I see it doing, just like a diaper in my belly hanging over. And maybe, though, I would be smoking a cigar.
Well, this is the lovely thing about your comedy is you wouldn't even need to wear the diaper. You could just describe the diaper, and that's the way, you know, like...
That would be better.
Yeah, that would be easier.
For everybody.
For everybody.
That's true. You're right. That is a skill to just paint a picture.
Sure.
Like, imagine if I was a toddler who came out and I was in a diaper, you know, and like, hi everybody. One time I did come out in a diaper. I did a bit. It was pretty good. I was the Lindbergh baby.
Okay.
And I just came out and I said, nobody really looked for me. Like, I was saying, I was alive the whole time, you idiots. I was right by the house. And now I was full grown, but I still had the diaper on. It was a weird bit.
But I'm thinking of the bit in your current show, and I know you're rotating the material around. There's
a little bit.
When I saw you on your first gig here, I was gutted to see that you didn't do the how'd you get the shirts so fresh.
Oh, I didn't.
You didn't do that bit. And the first thing I was saying, "God, do the shirts bit, do the shirts."
Oh, okay.
But in your just go and see him. It's incredible. But in your in the show that I did see, you did the lounge singer having flashbacks of a war.
Yeah, I do a lounge singer that has war flashbacks.
Yeah, and that's like a similar thing. It's not a sketch, but it's stand-up that kind of pertains to sketch somehow. You're going, what would it be like if? And then putting a character in a situation, but that character is still you. So there's kind of layers of character very subtly on you as the performer.
Right. Because I'm so, like I'm so rageful or confused about life, or, you know, that I like to scream because it's cathartic.
Yeah.
So then I could put it into this, you know, like I love juxtaposing things.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, is taking the screaming, you know, battle flashbacks and putting them next to the relaxed.
That's what I like to do. I like extremes.
Perfect.
Like the guy who's going, you know, everything is beautiful. No! Fucking Frankie, get down! That is the way I do. Like, you know.
Yeah.
I like psychosis, basically. Let's go, honey.
So in your we're digressing interestingly into your process, but just to finish this journey of you becoming a comedian from doing your acting work and the sketch work, improv and things like that.
Right.
Whereabouts did Last Comic Standing fit into that process?
which is
a reality show in the States.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so funny. Like I you know, being in LA, you're just around people who develop shows, mm-hmm. and stuff. And so I knew the developer of the show, and he wanted me to be on Last Comic Standing. Like, I despise reality shows, mm-hmm. because there's nothing more fake than a reality show.
Sure.
Which is a funny, you know, which is, you know, they call it a reality show and it's the opposite, because everybody is playing for the camera and nobody is being real.
Did you have to get out of cars several times? That's the thing. From the one I did, you'd turn up in a taxi and they'd reshoot it 8 times.
What I hated is that they're telling... Well, I hated a lot of things about the show, but what I hated is that, like, they're telling a bunch of comedians, come on, guys, look happy. They would say that to comedians. Like, you know, miserable comedians, you know. Like, come on, guys, you're supposed to be looking happy here. You're in front of the Vegas. We taped it in Vegas, you know, which is the unhappiest place on earth. Everybody's gambling away their future and making horrible life decisions, you know. And they're telling us to, like, look happy. And a lot of the comics were desperate, and they would be like, yeah, you know, they really wanted to win this thing. But, you know, me and this other guy, his name is Russ Meneve, and we would just be like, fuck them. I'm not looking happy. And we got into being like, yeah, we're here. And they hated us.
Yeah.
They hated it. The producers were like, oh, God, these bastards, you know.
So this is, I mean, I'm not intimately acquainted with how the show works. You were a fully-fledged stand-up before you went into it.
But
it wasn't
like
a new, it wasn't a new act show.
It wasn't a what?
It new act, a no. New act, no. Okay.
No, they were taking people who, you know, had done it for a while.
Okay.
And so it was a surprise to me that, you know, I just was like, okay, I'll do this. And then I kept going further and further in the competition.
I'm trapped in reality.
Yeah. I'm trapped in reality. that's what it should have been called. I'm trapped in a contrived reality. But I kept going further and further in this competition. But it's so weird that, I mean, and here's the other thing I hated, is that they're pitting comedians against each other.
Yeah.
Like, who is funnier? And that's the thing about comedy, is that, you know, I mean, who is funny? I mean, it's different tastes. You know, there's so many different types of comedy, you know, and to make it a competition, they made it like a beauty pageant. You know, like I swear to God, I found myself on a stage in Las Vegas, because to get into what they used to do is that I was in the semifinals, and to get into if you got into the finals, you got to live in a house where for 2 weeks, and luckily I lost.
God.
You know, even though it would, you know, everybody was saying how good it would have been for my career or whatever. But anyway, I found myself on stage and they're picking the finalists. I think there were 16 of us, and they were getting it down to 8. And I really felt like I was in the Miss America pageant. We were all on the stage just going, you know, everybody's like, oh, God, I hope I make it. And I was like, I hope they don't pick me.
In the diaper at the time with the sash.
Yeah. Oh, my God. God, yeah.
Okay, so coming out of that show and getting back to stand up. Now I've listened to your album, A Great Stillness. Mm. That's your debut album? That's your first?
That's release? Yeah. That's the first one that I actually bothered recording, because okay. I think
that's what made me think you were newer than you actually are, is that I was the only one I could find. So you'd made other right. kind
well,
of
well no I actually recorded another album, but it was just purely characters and it wasn't that well done.
Okay.
That one is called The Big Push, because I did like a series of one man shows, because I tend to do, you know, I just love the conceptual thing. Like one of the things I did was like on The Big Push was I love, I'll just give you a little bit. It was sure. like a police sergeant going, folks, it was like a press conference. We have a crazy dentist. No, it would start, it would be like, folks, we have someone who is going around and injecting people with Novocaine. We're calling him the Novocaine Bandito. He likes to watch different parts of people go numb. We believe it's a dentist who has a lot of time on his hands. And, you know, it was funnier than that, but Sunday morning.
Yeah, man.
But so that was a CD I recorded, which is crazy okay. characters. But this Great Stillness was really, it came out of the documentary that's being filmed, that was filmed about me.
Okay.
And we did it live at the Gotham Comedy Club in New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the album, The Great Stillness, is linked to
the documentary.
So that was, it's the documentary of the making of that album.
No. The documentary just follows me around for a year and gets into my family life with my, okay. With my dad.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's being screened, excuse me.
Oh yeah.
That's being screened tonight in the,
Yes, it's being screened tonight. You should go to it if you can. It's late though. 11:15 in the Caves in the big room. There's a screening, and then we're going to release the movie. It looks like late fall.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. So So those the earlier work you were talking about, the Novocaine Bandido and all that kind of stuff. That at what point in your stand-up practice did that come out? Because it seems like if that did that happen before you were doing regular stand-up as yourself, or was it a parallel process?
Yeah, it seemed to be like a parallel process that I would, you know, I was doing one-man shows, like just one-man shows,
okay,
where I would just go from character to character. And I think that was helping me build up my confidence,
okay,
in front of audiences to just be a pure stand-up. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
Like instead of just a guy who goes, oh, this is, you know, a show about characters, you know, not me.
Mm-hmm.
Just characters. Mm-hmm. But I think it gave me the courage to say, okay, I can, you know, drop that veil and just come out as Eddie Pepitone, mm-hmm, and be with everybody and then put in the characters. So I think it was, you know, a parallel thing.
Sure. So let's talk then about the relationship between you, the real Eddie Pepitone, and the persona, the stage Eddie Pepitone. Mm. Is there, I mean, it seems, right, in your work that I've heard, there's a lot of autobiography. There's a lot of, like, one of the things I always described to friends before I came up here, I hadn't heard of you, was the bit when you're, I think it's in the She's Adorkable bit, when you're on the phone and you ring your wife and go, it's me, me, me. Like, and it's just this beautiful little moment of just finding this howling cosmic pain in this little moment of just ringing someone you know and going, it's me. And then there's this feeling that somehow they don't recognize it.
Yeah. I think that comes from just, you know, my insecurity that nobody is ever paying attention to me.
Yeah, exactly. That's
you know what I mean? And like, I think that's a thing with comedians in general, is that we so badly need to be the center of attention. Like I even notice it, and I don't know if this makes me seem like a bad person, but I even notice it when I've been living with the same woman for I think 3 years, and like when she comes home, you know, if I'm in the apartment and she comes home and she doesn't immediately say things to me, I'm like, what the fuck? You know? And like I just am so needy, I realize. And so stand up is such a great way to like get out that need, and then maybe you don't emotionally destroy the people in your lives.
And is that something that's happened in the past? Have you?
Take it easy. I mean, yes, it has.
But I mean, there's. I know. Me and my friends talk about our girlfriends being comedy widows. You know, because they are. You know, you don't see your partner as much as you'd like to. You're obviously. I mean, my girlfriend. I nearly called her my current girlfriend there, which I will be editing. What I mean is
my current girlfriend.
I don't mean that at all. What I mean is my. There's no way out.
That is a person who knows that things are transient.
Oh.
Nothing is permanent. It's very Buddhist.
Babe, I love you. I love you. She's your biggest fan, Eddie. She's definitely going to be listening to every inch of this recording. What I mean is, my girlfriend, for the first time, this is the first girlfriend I have gone out with who has a regular job, a 9-to-5 office job. And as a result, previously, I've been in relationships with performers who, it's easier to be in a relationship with a performer in terms of the structure of your... I'm trying to prove this to you and her now. And what I mean is that
do you want us to leave and you could just...
Yeah, I'll just keep recording. Was the difficulty of keeping together a relationship with someone who works a regular job when you work evenings, weekends, and as well are possibly a terrible, needy person, because the very fact that you're into stand-up is arguably a kind of mental illness, you know?
No doubt about it.
Yeah, well, it is.
No doubt about it. Yeah, that is difficult. I mean, right now, I've been away because before I've done Edinburgh, I did Dublin, and then before that, I was taping a show in Atlanta for a network called Adult Swim, which is this animated network that does crazy shows. And before that, I was in San Francisco, so I haven't seen, you know, my she's my fiance now for almost 2 months, and it's getting strange, you know, strained. Like I'm Skyping her. I feel like I'm doing communiques.
Yeah,
I have the headphones on, Skyping her through the computer. Honey, like I'm talking into the computer.
Yeah.
Sweetheart, I'm here in Edinburgh. Yes, no, I love you so much, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, we need to see each other. It's been a long time, you know what I mean? I'd say, you know, how much can I tell her about? There's a lot of flyers here. You know, what do you fucking say? By the way, one of the bits I thought of, because you were talking about how do you come up with bits and stuff,
sure.
Is that you guys ever see, you know, Apocalypse Now, where, you know, Colonel Kurtz is just like, I feel like what I want to make a video, you know, because the festival's long, and it's a long haul for a comic to do a month of fucking shows, and I just want to be at the end of the festival like Colonel Kurtz, just stroking my head, surrounded by flyers. Just going to flyers. Instead of the horror, just the flyers. The flyers.
I think that'll work. I think that's got to be the opening of next year's show. Are you going to come back next year? Would you come to Edinburgh again?
Give me him. I don't know. I want to make it through this year. Yeah, I'm sure I'll be back, you know. I'm sure I'll be back.
And you're enjoying
it. It would be funny to like make that statement now. I am definitely going to, but probably.
Yeah. Yeah. We were talking about the venues before. We were talking about your issues with the Hugh Grant story.
Oh my God, that is so funny. I just love the hilariousness that Hugh Grant came to see me, which is just funny, you know, because why would Hugh Grant come to, like, it's so random to me. But one of the guys who's a big fan of mine happens to know Hugh Grant, and he was like, you got to see this guy Eddie Pepitone. Hugh Grant happened to be here. So he came to the Tron, I think, with 9 women. I kid you not. And 2 of them didn't have ID, and they turned away Hugh Grant and his party. Yeah. And so, you know, my producers were really pissed off about it. And we moved from the Tron to another venue now because they've been turning away people like that, you know, and to do it to Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
You know, let Hugh Grant in with his 9 women.
Friends. Yeah.
Just for me.
You've brought some notebooks with you. If you wouldn't mind having a look at some of those. We were talking about your writing week. Or I mean, I know you said you are not a disciplined writer.
No, I'm not. I mean, you could see my notebooks. They are like the scribblings of a madman.
For the benefit of the listener, there was some sort of fluid spilled on several of those pages.
Could be coffee,
tears.
But you know, I'm just all about stream of consciousness. Like I was, and I write about the apocalypse a lot. Like the apocalypse is always going. You know, I live in LA, and it's right now. It's so blisteringly hot there, and it's a desert, Los Angeles. That, you know, and it's like it gets so hot there. And there's earthquakes occasionally, and then there's wildfires, and I feel like I'm just in an apocalyptical landscape out there. And it's such a weird place because then they're making television, and you know, the weather goes from hot during the day to freaking really beautiful at night. Like the nights in Los Angeles are very beautiful. So it's a very kind of seductive place that's also a horrible place as well. Like, I love this climate in Scotland, you know. Do you guys?
It's not always like this.
It's not always like
no,
this?
No. This is very misleading.
What's the bad part of it?
It's kind of constant rain.
It never rains in Los Angeles. And me and my fiance, when we see a cloud, we get excited.
Okay.
Like, honey, a cloud. It might rain. Like, I hate the sun. I'm kidding. That's a weird thing to say, right? Like, I hate life. But anyway, I'm always writing about.
So are you a note taker? Do you always have a notebook with you?
For you know, I used to when I first started. When I first started, I would carry around a recorder and look like a lunatic on the street because I would constantly be going, great idea. You find a quarter on the street and then you collapse and fake a heart attack. like whatever popped in. No, I was really a believer when I first started out that you have to be so diligent whenever a funny thought comes into your head, you know? But that was really draining after a while. Like, I'd be with friends and I'd be like, hold on, dinner party, really boring dinner party. Really boring dinner party where you go into the bathroom and put on a fake mustache so you can get out of there. They don't recognize you. Or whatever it was. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was a lot of work, I mean, to always carry around a notebook. And I realized that if you did it that way, what it would do to me is that I would never enjoy life. Because I would constantly be like, okay, I'm going to leave my apartment today and let's see what's funny.
Yes.
And it was such a strain. So I stopped doing that. And now I'm just kind of more, you know, organic about the process. Like, you know, just throughout the day, you know, if, you know, I'll just be just like living my life. And maybe at the end of the day, or I usually take, what I usually do is I like to write comedy in when I wake up. Okay. And what helps me write comedy now is Twitter and Facebook.
Okay, yeah.
Because Twitter and Facebook is such a great thing because it's a captive audience. You know, I have all these followers. I think I have 41,000 followers on Twitter, and then I have 5,000 people on Facebook. So it's like I write jokes and immediately there's this instant gratification of like, ooh, it's being retweeted.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, this person says it. Like, it's like having an audience right there. So it helps me just write all these things.
Sure. And I mean, one of the things you're known for on Twitter, or something that I see a lot, I'm one of the 41,000, is your to-do lists.
Yeah, I have formats. Like, I have to-do lists. Like, one, hose out trunk so dead body smell leaves. Two, find God. Three, buy egg. Like disparate, crazy stuff. Like, that's how I like to think. I was very influenced by Monty Python growing up. Mm-hmm. And I love random, crazy, silly things.
Sure.
You know?
And is that part of your, is that again something that you just do when they occur to you? Or is that a discipline that you go, okay, I'll do a to-do list? Or is it something that just spills out?
It's kind of a discipline when I wake up. But okay. I mean, but it just spills out of me all that randomness, you know? And I'm still finding a way. I do bring tweets into my act now.
Yeah.
I carry around like a folder and I scream, these are my tweets.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm old school. I don't keep them in a phone or a computer. You know, I carry my tweets with me. And nobody fucks with you when you have your tweets with you and you're on the streets going, these are my tweets. People run the other way. But it's interesting what'll get like a big laugh on Twitter. Like I one of my tweets is cramming for a prostate exam today. There's just something about the wording of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Or the only thing stopping me today is genetics, brain chemistry, lack of income, time and place I was born in, and lethargy.
Yeah.
That's the only
thing.
But
there is, I mean, there's a real crossover there. That's very unusual for comedians. Most comedians I talk to about Twitter say that, oh, it's a sort of a silly little thing where something isn't good enough for the stage and you kind of dump it on Twitter. Or it's, I don't know, that's a fairly common thing I've heard.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it suits a particular type of short wordplay joke or a joke that's better written down. But there's real, your Twitter usage is so, it's so you, it's so of you and of your persona that it has that direct translation to the stage.
Right.
It makes perfect sense somehow that you be...
Right. I'm also going to put out a book since it's so formatted with the to-do list, and I have another form that is called... I call signs that things aren't going well.
Yeah.
And I list things like signs that things aren't going well. One, you cry in your car. You know, two, you like to go off to... You like to drop cake from roofs. And... and again, it's just random, crazy stuff, you know. Three, you talk about butter a lot or whatever, yeah. You know. So I'm going to put out a book with the those different lists. So look for that. No, I'm kidding.
We'll put a link on the website. For like the six people. So we'll, I meant who listen, not who are interested in that. Sorry,
I feel like I'm your girlfriend. You're a pilot.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Look, didn't mean
my current guest.
My current guest. What? You're having other guests? You didn't tell me that. I thought I was the only guest ever.
Yeah, you are. It's all built around you. It's an elaborate hoax. I basically just wanted to meet you, Eddie. So I faked the whole thing. I'm really sorry.
I go out and everybody's an android.
Yeah.
No one is real.
Speaking to the androids for a second, if you we've got about 10-15 minutes left. There'll be some time at the end for questions, so I'd just like to flag that up now so that you can have a think, because I've noticed throughout the show, with this one in particular, we've been getting not heckles, but certain androids have been going in a very sort of I agree. So I'm expecting some very perceptive questions for Eddie.
Don't put that much pressure.
Oh no, I want them. The androids,
I'm expecting the questions to be perceptive yet slightly funny.
Yeah. So looking just at your notebook, which, as you say, is like you are handwriting notes. Do you ever sit and type? Do you ever put these in a form?
Typing. I mean, I hate writing on the computer. Maybe because of my age, you know, 53, I just like writing longhand, you know? Mm-hmm. But you have to put it on the computer at some point so you can print it out and read it. I mean, it's hard for me to even read my own writing at this point. But, yeah.
Okay.
What was the question? And
it was a sort of an open-ended, writing kind of question.
It'd be funny if we were both so amorphous. Like, do you?
Mm, yeah.
And I'm like, and people are like, Everybody's had a stroke. Yeah. Your listeners are all stroke victims.
And so when it comes to structure,
that'd be great if the act was like that too. Hey, folks, coffee, eggs, just one word, everybody can understand it.
Oh, that's beautiful. We've reinvented it there. That's
reinvented
it. Oh my God, Eddie Pepitone.
Relationships.
God, it's like audio mime.
Audio mime. That's a good phrase, audio mime. The
comedy of...
I'm going to take that.
Yeah, that's yours. That's yours. I'm having your squirrel stuff. So... So is there something I was going to ask about your... two things. One is about the structure of your show. Now, I know a lot of UK acts, and I think this is actually symptomatic of the fact that Edinburgh is so popular, that UK comedians tend to, when they come here, and Australians, Canadians as well, you tend to have a theme. And people go, oh, this is my show today. You know, this year my show is about shopping, or my show is about my relationship.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. And they kept asking me that before...
Okay.
I came out here. What's your show about? What's your show about?
Yeah.
You know, meaning what's the theme? And I was like, oh, I don't.
Yeah, no, you're not supposed to have one. You're American.
And is that right?
Americans don't have themes. Americans come out and go, in my experience, certainly American comedy albums, the American shows I've seen, talking to Hannibal Buress yesterday.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's not about anything. It's all of my best, funniest jokes. Whereas the UK acts, we seem to be in this, I think because there's so much competition specifically at this festival, that in order to stand out, people go, okay, this year it's all about ice. But, you know, the ice in our hearts. And at the end of the show, at the end of the show, my dad dies. And then, there we are. You know, and that's the kind of theme, isn't it, you know? You go, and it turns out my dad was a snowman, and you go, oh, this is the ice show.
So it's about ice and your father's death? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds like a hit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of, you know, and I subscribe to that as well. I'm sort of mocking my own thing. You know, I'm doing a show this year. It's about selfishness. It's kind of about, you know.
Well, that isn't a bad idea. I realize, you know, that it's nice to, like, lay a structure on it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I was just describing the to-do lists and the signs that things aren't going well. And I think, you know, it is good to lay, and I've been learning this slowly because, you know, I'm so chaotic and random in my thinking that, you know, putting structure on it, like, oh, okay, this stuff is about the apocalypse. It really helps, you know, it really helps get your thinking in a certain direction. And it actually, I think, helps the creative process, you know, to have a structure on it, because it then forces your mind to, like, not go off. I don't know. I think it just forces your mind to be more focused. And the more focused you are, the deeper the vein of creativity is. I love listening to myself talk about
it. I love it. No,
because part of the way through, I'm like, who are you fucking bullshitting?
No.
You're such a bullshit artist. I'll just go home and write random shit after this. After I talk about structure.
No, this is the stuff. This is the thing that, like, my geeky comedy fan listenership is fascinated by. It's very often the moments when people go, oh, that sounds really pretentious. That's exactly the stuff we want. I think there's absolutely a lot of truth in that.
Yeah. Like, so I have a lot of apocalyptical things. Like, I think I just jotted down, during the apocalypse, there'll be porn showing in coffee shops. Like, you'll just walk into a coffee shop and there'll just be horrific pornography being shown all over the place because society will have broken down, but you'll still be ordering very casually, like, a latte, please. Double shot, and you'll be hearing, like, fuck me, fuck me. Yeah, can I have extra? Anyway, it's a dark bit.
So is there something that you, like, do you have maybe a note that you've made recently that we could look at how you would go about unpacking that to find the funny in it? Is there something that's not currently part of your set?
Let's see. I wrote, because I'm always trying to lose weight. It's a losing battle, but I go, dieting is sad. What kind of life is that? Avoiding the good places. I open the door to the places I want to eat and yell, I want to be in here. I want to be in here, but my doctor tells me I can't. And then leave. Yeah. So that's just an idea, okay, I had. So, you know, how would I develop that?
Yeah, that's a case of taking that idea on stage and sort of trying to inhabit it, or would you go, okay, there's that, and would you go, right, I'll get on one now, and I'll sit down and I'll write for an hour around that subject?
Yeah, well, for me, I would take that on stage and talk about how, you know, I don't eat in pizzerias anymore, but I go in there and I just walk around going, I really want that, and, you know, but now, and I also, for me, like, whenever I am dieting or exerting any kind of discipline, I always feel superior to other people. Like, I immediately am like let's say I quit. Like, I remember when my dad quit smoking. My dad quit. He smoked cigarettes. He would then see someone smoking and go, those will kill you.
Yeah.
Like, sure. He immediately was like the guy who was like, I quit. Why can't you?
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean? So And so, like, that bit about me dieting, I would think of an idea, like, of me going into restaurants and just making an announcement to the people eating stuff that I don't think is good for them. Like,
gotcha.
Folks, how could you be eating that pizza? Look what it did to me. Like, just, look, you got to eat salads. You have to eat salads. Fresh vegetables. You're idiots. Like, that would be
like a reverse mascot for the pizza.
Yes, okay. The reverse. Nice. Okay.
So when you're doing that kind of work, when you're improvising, I mean,
I do a lot of improv. Like I said, I was in an improv company.
Sure.
So I'm very, you know, I'm very used to being in the moment. And really, for me, the joy of stand-up is not so much doing the material that's very written. It's finding the humor in the moment, because it's so immediate when you're on stage and you're like, oh God, I have this bit now, and it's being written right with these people. It's not in front of these people, but with these people. You know what I mean? Like, we are writing this together, you know, because you're inspiring me. This audience is inspiring me to be funny, because the impetus to be funny is to make these people laugh. You know, that's the high of the whole genre, is like, we are experiencing joy together. And there seems to be, for me, less joy in doing stuff that I know so automatically, as opposed to the joy of something new for me and them, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you find that? I mean, the idea of going on stage just with an idea and improvising it, it's something I've tried. I tend to be quite written. It's a very attractive idea, and I'm sure to a lot of comics listening to this, and maybe people here today, they'll be thinking, that's what I want to do. Obviously, that comes with an inherent risk that sometimes
you'll flop
and it won't be funny.
If you're doing that, I've got a great idea about going into restaurants and talking about, how people are idiots for eating this kind of food. And if it gets nothing, you're like, that wasn't that fucking funny, you know? And then you tend to go back to the stuff that works.
Sure.
Okay. You know, you're like, okay, fuck the improv. Like, you can immediately go, who the fuck am I? I can't believe I was talking about that on that podcast.
Yeah.
I better do that written stuff really quickly.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, that's the risk.
And you have to push through that risk on stage, presumably. There has to be times when you're improvising around a subject in front of a room full of people who are just staring at you. And do you, one of the options is to go, hey, well, that bit didn't work, and fall back on prepared stuff. But also, presumably, in that kind of crucible, that moment of, wow, maybe I'll keep going and push harder. You need to, I mean, presumably, like, do you ever feel nervous? Do you ever feel like, this is tanking and you're choking?
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting. Some nights, you know, and it really depends on the night. Like, some nights I'll have the courage to push through that you know, feeling of rejection of the idea, and push through and keep going. And then I'll find it, because I'm just being so extreme and pushing through. And then I'll find it. But other nights, you know, I'll feel that and go, I'll just go, oh, forget it. I can't do it tonight. And that's really, I find, I don't know about you, but I find when I'm performing, so much of it is like the night and how I'm feeling physically and the crowd, and like all these factors come into, you know, what you're going to perform that night or how you're going to perform that night. Can I put this away now?
You're allowed to put that away now. we'll go over to the androids. We've just got a couple of minutes. If any of you have some... perceptive and yet slightly funny. No, or would like to know anything at all, please don't feel any pressure on that part. I've killed the questions, haven't I? Yeah, I've got, there's a lady there. If you ask through me, and just for the sake of the recording.
Yeah, you know why? Because I'm sick of America. that's partly true, but because, and I love this, because I went to Dublin before this and then here, is that it's unbelievable how I didn't know of these UK comics. Like, for some reason, it doesn't make it to America. Like, for instance, I saw the Irish comic Tommy Tiernan. He's like, I'm like, when I saw him live in Dublin for the first time, and I was like, how do I not know of this guy? How is that possible? He's like one of the best comedians I've ever seen in my life. So I really just wanted to broaden my world. It's like, why do you travel? You know what I mean? Because you want to be exposed to new ideas. And like, I'm watching, you know, all these comics out here, and I'm like, oh, wow, this is, there's a world of comics. Not just, because you get really stuck in a rut, you know, seeing the same people and being in the same country and stuff. So that's why. And then the other big reason is that it forced me out of my comfort zone. And whenever you force yourself out of your comfort zone, it's painful, but you always grow. Like I'm expecting to come, like, once the festival is over and I go back to the States, I'm expecting that I'm going to have a big spurt in growth, you know, but who knows, maybe I'll just shrivel up and die.
There is no finer place on which to end the show. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in thanking Mr. Eddie Peppertone?
Thank you.
So that was Eddie. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, it's eddiepeppertone.com. You can follow Eddie at Eddie Peppertone. He does some wonderful, wonderful regular stuff on Twitter. His website, as I said, has a link to both his album, A Great Stillness, his documentary, The Bitter Buddha. And also, he does, I think, I don't know if they're daily or weekly, he puts up little video episodes. They can't be daily. He can't work that hard. Little video episodes called Puddin', which are just 1 minute long little YouTube clips, which are very, very funny as well. So go and check those out. Remember, James A. Caster is coming on the show on a special live edition. That's Wednesday, the 6th of February. Details at the website, comedianscomedian.com, and indeed on the Facebook page. So please do that. Keep telling everybody about it. And we want Sea Creatures and War. Edinburgh show titles for Sea Creatures and War. Tweet them to me with the hashtag funny for no money if you're a non-comedian, and hack for cash if you're a comic. Thank you very much. Next week, Mike Gunn. Speak to you soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.